Hello, you are hearing the podcast series on the rule of law and corporate actors. And today we talk about extremely important component of the rule of law, access to justice. And my distinguished guest today is Professor Robert McCockerdale. Dear Professor, I appreciate very much that you agreed to be a guest of this podcast. It's extremely valuable for us. Professor Mark Crocodile is an international lawyer who has experience of research, legal advice, litigation, teaching, training, and publications. He works a lot with companies, law firms, governments, international organizations, and civil society on business and human rights issues. Professor is a member of the UN Working Group on Business and Human Rights, and he is a lawyer, practitioner lawyer. He was a professor in law schools for nearly 25 years. He was director of the British Institute of International and Comparative Law for 10 years, and he has been ranked as an eminent practitioner in business and human rights by Chambered Partners Global Ranking. So, hello, dear professor.
Thank you very much, Elena, for asking me to join you.
Yes, thank you. And so the key question for our discussion today is following: access to justice in litigations against private companies. Does the rule of law have potential to overcome barriers? But I would like to start with a question that I ask all my guests. What are your associations when you hear the rule of law and corporate actors? Because it's not very common seen still. It's not very common still for our discussions about business and human rights.
Thank you for that question. I guess when I first heard, when you first alerted me to that was one of the issues you were going to raise, what I immediately think of course, is what do I mean by the rule of law? And I particularly think of situations where the lack of most elements of the rule of law in a state usually mean that the victims of human rights abuses by business have no means of access to an effective justice in that state.
Yeah, I totally agree. And what do you think? What criteria we can use to assess the impact of corporate actors on the general rule of law environment in a concrete country?
Well, I think that what I see is, whereas for most businesses, having a rule of law in a state is actually enormously beneficial because they've got legal certainty, clarity, they know if they've got a dispute, they can have it resolved. However, for some businesses, they can use the lack of a rule of law in a state to operate in a way where they consider that they are completely unaccountable for their actions, including actions which lead to human rights abuses. They know that the government will support them against protests by local communities, that they can fire workers without legal consequences, and they can pollute or whatever without going to be prosecuted, or in fact, without the courts finding in against them. And they can also be involved, of course, in corruption in this whole process without any kind of accountability. And they can say they're simply following the law in the state, whatever that might be. I guess the criteria I start with is under the UN Guiding Principles. Guiding Principle 23 says that businesses simply following the law in a state, that's not enough. That businesses should also seek ways to honor the principles of internationally recognized human rights. And so that means that simply following the national laws, which in many ways, sometimes even these businesses have helped create, is not sufficient. So we need to look back at the UN guiding principles and say, if the businesses are not acting in accordance with international human rights law, then they are acting contrary to the UN guiding principles. And so compliance with the rule of law in that state is not enough. We need to look higher than that at international human rights law.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for this point. And When we talk about barriers to access to justice in general, as usual, we list the legal barriers, for example, discriminatory laws and policies, lack of legal certainty, and so on. We talk about social economic barriers, cultural barriers, and many other things. Are these general barriers relevant in the situation of human rights abuses by corporate actors in the same regard, and what's the most influential barrier in these cases could you name?
Okay, I'm going to start by just going back one step, if that's okay, Lena, to what do we mean by the rule of law? Because the rule of law, of course, includes many elements, legality, legal certainty, prohibition of arbitrariness, respect for human rights, non-discrimination and equality, and also access to justice for independent and impartial courts. That's what the Venice Commission kind of considered what the rule of law is. And I have argued in the International Comparative Law Quarterly that the international rule of law has many of the same elements. The reason I say that is access to justice is really, really important, but it's not the only element of a rule of law or the only element that might affect the ability to have access to justice. And so, for example, the rule of law is, of course, not the same as the rule by law or the rule by lawyers. So simply because there's a law in the state does not make it the same as the rule of law. And that can often be where some of these barriers are. And so, for example, access to justice, in my view, has to include an access to an effective remedy. Simply going to a court or having even an impartial and independent court, but without an effective remedy is still problematic. And so firstly, this remedy has to be being able to be enforced. And also, my big concern in this is if the remedy, even as determined by an independent and impartial court, is a fine to be paid by a business, that is not a remedy to a victim. Even a criminal sanction of the business is not a remedy to the victim. So I think before I can get to the barriers, I have to be clear that what we're looking for in the rule of law with an access to justice should include a remedy to the victim. And the remedy has to be also appropriate to that victim and their particular circumstances, such, I don't know, they've got disabilities, there are gender issues, there are location issues, and that remedy is preventative and also has deterrent aspects. So having said all that, let me come back to one of your many questions about the general barriers, which you've expressed really well. I guess I would say that many of those barriers are the same. But because of the transnational situation of many legal actions in this area, because in many instances, it's the victim lives in the global south, the business is headquartered in the global north, how do they even get to the stage of being able to bring a claim? I tend to think of this as a practicing lawyer is, where does it begin if you're taking through a claim? My starting point is, well, how do you even know you've got a claim? Secondly, what are the costs? How do you secure legal representation for bringing the claim? What resources do you have? Very often you have lack of resources or even the time to bring the claim. And then you have to find from the business what information they have, because usually most relevant information is held by the business itself, which they don't want to give up. Then there might be procedural limitations, which could be restrictive time limits. It could be that the claim is unavailable in your own state because of rule of law and other instances. So then you have to look abroad. So then you're thinking what immunities or non-justiciable doctrines there are by the courts or other limitations of applicable law and things. And the simple complexity of corporate structures, working out who are you bringing the claim against. And only then can you begin to think, okay, how do I prove my human rights violation and how do I enforce it? If I can give an example, there are many cases against Shell for its pollution and actions in the Niger Delta in Nigeria. with claimants arguing that their human rights, including those arising from environmental damage, have been breached. For example, I was in, had a minor role in a case against Shell in the United Kingdom. And in that instance, it took 12 years to get to the stage that the UK Supreme Court held that Shell's parent company, based in the UK, did have a duty of care to those people affected by the actions of Shell's subsidiary in Nigeria. It hasn't even got to the remedy stage. That's still going on. Mm-hmm. In the Netherlands, the Hague Court of Appeal has given a remedy to the victim based on very similar facts. But it took 17 years since the first oil spill until that decision was made. And that's because of many barriers to access to justice. But of course, we have to be realistic. In most instances around the world, they never even get to court. Even if they do, as I say, it can take many, many years. So I guess what I'm saying is many of these barriers are still there and are still very, very present. Another question you asked is, what are the most influential barriers?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think once again, if we go back to the base where most victims start, even if they're workers, a key barrier is lack of knowledge about their own rights and what they can do. And even the language to use, because let's say in the Global South, they may not even speak the language of the business or the language of the state. So they have to undergo quite a considerable amount of knowledge increase. And then there's little practical and legal support for them. The business can very much feel all powerful, linked into the state so closely that the state will support them in every way. And often the business is the key financial support for a community. So if victims protest, they can lose their jobs, lose the community, mm-hmm. put in jail without any access to remedy even for that. And so for victims who do manage to start a complaint, usually it'd be much, much better if they can bring a claim in their own state. But that's where your key point about the lack of a complete rule of law in a state means lack of legal aid, lack of legal expertise, lack of an independent and partial judiciary, means there's not even ability to bring a case, or if they do, it'll be dismissed. So I guess what I'm saying is that the lack of kind of a rule of law is part of this, but often there are also other barriers which are practical depending on the situation of a particular state. And of course, some of those barriers can be ones which happen at a particular time, such as during a conflict or during a particularly difficult financial circumstance or a change of government. There are a whole range of factors which can also play into that. And so I guess what I'm saying is the type of barriers to access to justice will vary depending on particular circumstances and will also vary depending on obviously the location of the victims, because even if it's a victim in the global north, it's still not easy to get a claim. I mean, take a particular example. If it's a criminal case, it requires the prosecutor in the city where the business is based to bring a charge, which they may be reluctant to do because that business may be the major employer of the region. So that these barriers to justice, barriers of bringing a claim, are very, very present in most states, not just some. Sorry, that's a very long answer to your question.
But this answer actually gives a lot of information to further discussions. Yes, thank you very much. And I cannot avoid ask you about these current developments related to corporate sustainability due diligence directive. Do you see that these developments could change situation for access to justice positively?
That's a really good question. I think that obviously we're still in a little bit of uncertainty what the final form of the Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive will mm-hmm. be. But I think as a general rule, having states create good regulation on this area has to be a positive step, both for businesses, because they have legal certainty, but also for the victims involved, as long as there is an ability to bring some form of claim and some access to justice in that regard. Some of my concerns still remain. Is it going to be a remedy to the victim as against a fine to the business? I think that will still be a present issue in this, because some of the proposals only lead to a fine against or sanction against the business. Secondly, I think it will depend a bit on how the supervising authorities, which will vary in each state, decide to bring their actions, or at least their knowledge base. Thirdly, there is a worry of diversity across the EU, though I think this could be one way of getting a degree of coherence across the EU. I'm also concerned by the position of financial institutions, because I think financial institutions are major players in this and often seen as by some states as not having any human rights impact, but they can have adverse human rights impacts. If they are funding a company which then does certain things, if they have not done their own human rights due diligence, there is an adverse human rights impact. So those are some of the concerns I have. And I would just add one other, which is that there is a broad statement about to what extent has the Global South been involved in any of these discussions? Because that's where, as I said before, most of these victims come. Mm-hmm. Is that actually always the right area to right aspect in terms of looking at it purely from a global north? Whereas obviously there is an impact. And so I would like it to also include some capacity building in the Global South to enable that to happen in a way that business and human rights issues are more neatly aligned globally. The only other addition I would say is I like the fact that this is designed to cover outside the EU for those companies who are operating in the EU but not EU-based, but it still runs the potential, if you like, that the companies that are affected or are going to be directly impacted by this could still be a tiny minority of companies. Mm-hmm. I think that it could be potentially cause a problem. Why? Because it can even be your local shop, which say could be employing child labor, and yet somehow they're out of this kind of loop. So I think there are ways forward that this Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive could expand, but even on where it is now, with all the limitations it has, I think it is a good step forward in making clear businesses have responsibilities to respect human rights, and that is turning into an obligation.
Thank you very much. And also, no, I know that we have very different barriers and the role of different actors to solve particular problems could be also different. And of course, we can discuss it in very long conversation. But as I have an aim to try to compare the situation in Western democracies, well-established democracies, and in post-Soviet new democracies, I have, hypothesis that our region is not very active to promote business and human rights agenda, partly or mostly even because we have not very active civil society actors on issues of business and human rights, and actually legal practitioners are not really equipped with knowledge on business and human rights. And when I see developments, business and human rights developments in Western democracies, I have impression that in many cases, legal practitioners played and still play a crucial role, and some very popular cases were very important moments in the history of business and human rights. Could you confirm or this my thesis or not?
Yes, I can confirm that largely. Mm-hmm. However, it is still a very thin bit of knowledge, because let me just talk about what knowledge, mm-hmm. legal knowledge even, is required for a business and human rights case. You have to know, yes, international and national human rights law. You also have to know a bit of international environmental law. You have to know your local corporate law. You have to know your local criminal law, your tort law, your contract law, your employment law, international labor law, competition law, corruption. There's actually an awful lot which you're trying to cram mm-hmm. in to try and understand even how to bring a claim, because a claim will rarely be packaged or argued even as a human rights claim. So most states do not enable a claim against a business for human rights. Human rights will fall under public law, and therefore against the state. So trying to fit it into any legal system is actually quite difficult. And so you're quite right, whereas there has been across a few states some developments in this area, there's an awful lot of states, even states which you and I would think of as kind of rule of law, democracy states, where there's very, very little law in this area. So there's still a considerable gap. And that's going to remain, sadly, for some time. And I've been working in this field, I don't know, 30 years. And it's gone at least from the stage where when I would talk to companies about human rights matters, they'd say, nothing to do with us, who cares, go away to the state, to where I now appear in the UN. And there's general consensus that issues of business responsibilities for human rights abuse should fall under a UN base. Mm-hmm. So I think there has been developments, but at the litigation level, it's still very slow. And to come back to your point about civil society, I think that is relevant, because if a company is operating in a particular way with abuse of human rights within a state where there's not a lot of civil society protest or action, they can often get away with it simply for lack of publicity. And certainly in our experience in the working group, when there's a complaint to us, what's called a communication, and we are concerned about a company's actions, sometimes the company will respond and sometimes not, partly depending on whether it feels there's a reputational consequence of it replying or not. And if it's, say, let's say you're talking about some of the Eastern European countries, there's no one who's brought that complaint even to the attention, we won't act on it. And the company involved will not take any action, even when we do act, because our field, no one's going to be kind of concerned about that. So I would encourage that even if there's no national action or even no method of complaint, at least bringing it to a UN body means if we then get the chance to act on it and we don't act on all complaints, at least there's then a sense to which a UN body has said we don't like what's going on. But you know, even in a vibrant functioning economy, businesses still have a strong role. And businesses, for many people, are often their first point of engagement with an economic power. They could be a subsistence farmer where they're sending all their products to a business. They could be working in a factory run by a business. And that's across the world, but particularly in places like Central European states. It's in a number of developing states around the world. And so that economic power of business also means very often governments are nervous of putting any restrictions on their powers, and therefore has a consequence that businesses can get away with their actions without any constraint. And that's where we began with the rule of law. Unless there are constraints against all actors, not just the state, then it can mean that businesses can do much more than they should do, and they can lead to adverse human rights impacts.
Thank you. And actually, this is very true. And in our region, governments are trying to be very business friendly, and it's one of the key barriers, I would say, to try to do anything, because all developments related on business and human rights actually are considered as barriers. Actually, for business environment, and actually, it's a one of key problem for us to change this kind of minds, you know.
I agree. Oddly enough, I've done a lot of research with companies, I've interviewed, surveyed, etc. And most companies in this area actually want clarity in the law. They often don't want no law. Obviously, some companies want no law because they want to get around it, but better companies often want some law on this because they want clarity as to what their obligations are. And also, for competitive reasons, they don't want the person, let's say, who's doing child labor undercutting them to be able to get away with it. But governments don't always see that. They only just think, oh, we're better to have no regulation.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. As a result, we have an opposite actually result that companies that would like to implement some responsible business practices, they avoid to implement them because they are afraid that they will be less competitive, because all other companies don't implement it. So actually, to be honest, my key hope that civil society and academic institutions will be more active in our region, and probably their efforts will push governments to do all these developments more actively, and that's why we have this podcast series, you know, to attract attention to these issues and to exchange experience. And thank you very much for your very, very valuable thoughts, and we will have our podcast in English and in Ukrainian, and I hope that it will make a contribution to developments in our region. Thank you very
I'm sure
much
it will.
Again.
And someone like you and the work you do is really crucial on this, not just in your kind of public profile and your engagement, but also in your influence of your students and of other sort of actors in your training, because that is your kind of ripple effect. If you begin to talk on this enough, it begins to have a broader impact. So no, I think people like you and the fabulous work you do are really, really important in moving forward this agenda. So it's a delight to be talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And I'm looking forward to our new meetings and new events with you. Thank you very much. It's always great pleasure for me to hear you. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bye.